Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
And here we go. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Inside College Soccer. I love the Twitter sphere. I do. We meet all kinds of amazing people. I've met friends and colleagues and all kinds of people through the Twitter sphere. And today I have one of those people, Dr. Erin Henderson, PhD, and she's been doing some amazing research on athlete burnout. And it's something that I've noticed. I feel like it's an increasing phenomenon in our society. I don't remember my friends when I was growing up and playing, any of us ever talking about burnout or feeling burnt out necessarily. We wanted to quit. We were done with it. We just quit. But it wasn't this drive to continue to play, even though you were feeling this burnout. You felt like you needed a break. And I feel like it's something that societally we are seeing an increase in the number of kids that are burnout. So I want to welcome to the podcast today, Erin Henderson. Hi, Erin. How are you?
Hi, I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Good. Now, you're located where? Where are you out of?
I live in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Right on. Okay. Yeah, Tennessee. I've been to Nashville, and I've been down to University of the South down in Sewanee, but I've never been exactly in your neck of the woods. So welcome to Inside College Soccer. I appreciate you coming on today.
Thanks. I'm pretty excited to talk about this.
All right. So let's go. Let's dig right into it. So you did a research project on something near and dear to my heart. So what was the title of your research project? What made you want to dig into this?
Yeah, so to give a little background, I grew up in Pennsylvania in a soccer family, one of five kids. All five of us played soccer. My parents were both coaches. My one older brother and myself went on to play collegiately. And I played, full scholarship. Soccer player, played for 2 years, and then transferred schools. And I moved into coaching for a couple of years. And then I just needed to step away from the game for a while. And when I did, it wasn't until my kids started playing soccer that I kind of got back into it. So, fast forward a lifetime of a career, climbing the corporate ladder and, doing those things, not anywhere in the sports, area. I had always really wanted to pursue my doctorate degree. And, you have to spend 4 years essentially studying a topic that could possibly be of interest to you. And as I got into it, I knew I wanted to explore burnout. Just professionally, I've seen that it seems to impact women more so than men, which made me wonder why. I think at some point in your career, you start to think about where's my legacy going to be? What are the types of things I can have a lasting impact on? And I have teenage daughters, and I watched the sideline culture. I watched their coaches. I watched the team interactions, and so it made me want to really focus in on what's affecting their mental health. What could I possibly do as a parent or researcher to make sure that they continue to love and grow in the games that they both play? And so I pursued my PhD and studied burnout in female athletes. Specifically, my population was college former college soccer players that played at the Division One and Two level. I initially started down the path of all team sport athletes, but the university really wanted me to hone in on one sport. So I went back to what I know, which is
soccer. Makes sense.
And so I specifically looked at two things. I looked at just their overall athlete burnout experiences, what caused it. And then I also really focused on how athlete leaders could prevent it. You know, what influence do the athlete leaders on a team have on people who have experienced burnout?
Aaron, I can't tell you how many kids that I've approached on the female side specifically, and studs, absolute studs on the field. And I would approach them to, what are your plans? Do you want to play college soccer? No, I think I'm just going to go to ABC and I think I'm done playing. And, you know, me being a man, feeling the way I felt as a player, it's like, why would you do that? You're wasting all of this talent. But they were just done. They were just done. Mm-hmm. And you're right. And your observations, anecdotally, I can tell you, are spot on, that it happens in female athletes more than in male athletes. Most of the, in fact, on the guys, it's the opposite. Even if they're no good, they still think they're good and they still think they want to play and they still think they can make it. And on the female side, there's a lot of very talented young women that are giving up the game. So what do you think is driving this?
I think there's a wide range of factors. It's so individualistic. You know, on one hand, you have women who tend to be perfectionists. And there's a fair amount of research that shows that, you know, perfectionism can put you at risk for things like burnout. So I think that's a piece of it. But part of what I was really surprised about during some of the interviews that I conducted were the number of people who touched on differing expectations that their coaches or administration had for them that were very different from their male peers, and added this extra pressure and stress and anxiety, you know, along the way. And so, you know, hearing things like, my coach expects me to have a 3.6 or, you know, 3.75 GPA, but I look over at the men's team or the men and they're taking easier classes and their coach doesn't care. You know, as long as they're eligible, that's fine. And so you have these this increased pressure to perform that seems to impact women, you know, to a greater extent than their male peers. And women are observing that too, which doesn't make it any better.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, during my coaching career, I coached for 9 of my 22 years, I coached male college team at the same time that I coached a female college team. So I have a hard time relating to the coach who says, guys, your classes aren't that important. I just need you to play. Cause I never felt that way about any of it. Cause I've always been the person that said, if you're going to do anything, give it your all, whatever it is, right? Take the right classes, do the very best you can. I mean, my expectations were high on male and female, but I can absolutely see programs out there that have the attitudes that you're talking about. Those programs do exist. I wouldn't say it's every men's program. That would be silly. And I wouldn't even say it's the majority of men's programs, because I know a lot of male coaches that are that are driving their athletes to excel academically and socially and from a community service aspect and from a player performance aspect. There's a lot of male coaches out there driven, but I can see that likely does happen in programs where the men are getting off easier. And I think part of it, Aaron, might be because there is truly a surplus of male soccer players that are trying to come into the system. And there was a shortage of top-notch female soccer players trying to come into the system. So maybe the coaches are looking at the male player as more disposable. If they
Yeah,
fail
that's
out, they
right.
fail out. There's 10 ready to take their place. It's your business. You're an adult. Do what you want to do.
Yeah,
Just finish the season and help me win.
what's interesting is there are women who feel that way anyway. That feel so, some of what they talked about is this difference in pressure and expectations on them, but they never seem to feel confident in their position on the team because they feel like there's all these other women who could come and replace me.
Right.
This super competitive element to, being a higher tier college athlete. It's interesting. It's something I focus on now. Both of my daughters are almost in recruiting phase. I have one that's a 2027 and one that's a 2025. And we talk a lot about, what do you want your goals to be? If you don't care about being a professional athlete, then do you really need to go to one of the top 10 programs and put that level of competition and stress into, what should be a really good experience? I'll tell you, Don, I'll be really interested to see how things change now that there are more professional opportunities for women. Some of the women I talked to talked about how they were doing all of these things, and there was a definitive end period
Right.
because there, the NWSL wasn't what it is today, or what it's
Right.
becoming. And so, it's I'm being pushed to get a 3.7. I'm not being able to take on any type of social life. I'm missing out on the normal college experience. And at some point, it's for what? Their athletic career has a very well-defined end date. So it'll be interesting to see how now that there's more opportunities for women, theoretically, in the United States, do more women feel like they could have a future after college soccer? And if so, how does that impact their mental health during the period of time which they're a college athlete?
Now, it's an interesting question, and absolutely there have been worldwide increased opportunities that weren't there 10 years ago for women. We talk about what's next, and when we talk about professional, I coached professionally for a short period of time, and a professional athlete to me is one that can pay all of their expenses for living and have money left over at the end of the day. And that, of all of the professional athletes in the world, that is a very small percentage that can do that. Most professional athletes are on, 400 a month, 600 a month, 800 a month, 1,000 a month. They can't even cover their own expenses. And professionalism means another form of pay to play. I mean, if I have to pay money out of my pocket to live in order to chase my dream, but I still am short of cash coming out of that endeavor, in this case, playing soccer, then is it really professional? There's an old country Western line, semi-pro means semi-paid, which is really what most professional soccer is. Ooh, I signed a contract. Really, you're semi-pro, part-time pro, part-time ditch digger, or whatever you are. And it's so. This reality of professionalism, I'm not sure that it really has changed, that it will change much on the women's side long run, because once you get the word out there that you aren't going to make a real living at this, and even if you make a living to barely pay your expenses, really, at the end of the day, you're still going to need something else to fall back on. You won't make millions and millions and then retire and never have to work again at 35. Like you might find in American football or basketball or baseball if they handle their money right. on the men's side, but on the women's side, and for the most part, on the soccer side, for most men, professionalism really doesn't exist. But it does give additional, you're right, it gives an additional step that they might be able to take past college for the 1%, 2% of the kids that are good enough to go make some sort of a living at it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
What do you think is happening through your research, Aaron? What do you think, what role do you think coaches, youth coaches and youth parents are playing? I know your focus was on the college side, but I am of a theory that burnout begins before college. We see almost 50% of the girls and 60% of the guys enter the transfer portal and then never leave. And what I'm thinking in my own head may be going on, and I don't know if your research can back up this thought that I have, is that kids are just kind of done playing even at high school, but they don't know how to tell their parents because they see the massive time, effort, energy, financial investment that's been made in them for the last 10 years and all the travel and all of the conversations that we're doing this because you're going to play college soccer and this pathway is necessary to play college soccer. Well, if I was a kid who loved my parents, I might not be able to tell them this isn't what I want. Thinking in my own head, I can't make them think that this whole investment was a waste of their time, effort, and energy. I owe my parents. I owe it to them to play in college. Then once they get into college, gosh, the transfer, I'm not starting. I'm a freshman. I never got to play. I'll enter the transfer portal. And then that school doesn't fit me. And that school doesn't fit me. And that school doesn't fit me. You know what? I'm just done playing. And I've even noticed that with kids selecting colleges, they make their list so high and so picky and the check boxes so few. And if it doesn't match all those check boxes exactly, then they just say, well, I couldn't find my fit. I couldn't. So I'm just going to go to my dream school and I got in and I'm just going to go to school and play. So I know that's a bit of a long rambling question for you, but I'm wondering if your research has found and backed up any of those thoughts that I have.
So you just covered a lot of topics, and certainly some of them are things that I have absolutely posted about. And some of them, you know, my research kind of looks at. Let me just start first by, you know, defining what is burnout, because it's a concept that really started in the healthcare industry in the 1980s. And then in the early 2000s, it moved into, you know, they started looking at what is burnout in different contexts. And so it's only been since about 2000 or so that we even have a definition. So it's really marked by three things. And for athletes, it's sustained emotional and physical exhaustion, a reduced sense of personal accomplishment, and sports devaluation. So those are fancy terms in some ways, but really what it means is athlete burnout can look like somebody is physically and mentally exhausted for a sustained period of time. They start to view their accomplishments and successes as insignificant. Or they start to, they stop thinking about their athletic journey. They start to devalue it. You know, it becomes less important to them over
right.
time. You don't have to necessarily have all three of those components to be considered burned out. And there's not exactly a formula that you can pull out that says, okay, if you're this percentage of all these things, you're burned out.
Then I'm burned out, right? Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, the root of it, though, is like this idea of chronic stress. And so I, as you mentioned, I did not specifically look at the adolescent piece, but actually that's where a lot of my homework building up to my study, where it started. And I did find that, you know, younger athletes, especially in soccer, soccer players, specifically female soccer players, are at a higher risk for experiencing burnout in youth. And it has a lot to do with how early with, you know, younger female soccer players tend to specialize. I mean, that's a piece of it. Obviously, you know, it's a topic that's a lot more complex, and but they're certainly at more risk. When I did some interviews, it was interesting to me that several women who said, you know, they had experienced burnout in college, as we were talking, they actually said, you know what, now that we're talking about it, I think I was actually burned out in high school.
Wow.
And they attributed it to starting the recruiting process.
I've been hearing that a lot. Yes.
And so it was really interesting. And so as I, you know, kind of pulled that out of them a little bit, the root of it was the recruiting process started to make it feel like a business.
I agree.
And not only did it start to feel like a business, it stopped being fun.
Yep.
And I could no longer make mistakes because I had people standing on
yes.
the sideline, and my parents really wanted me to get a scholarship.
Right.
And so, you know, some of what you're talking about is really supported by not only my study, but I've published a couple of times on my Twitter, the NCAA, you know, data, their own data shows that these kids are reporting, I say kids, you know, when they get into college, they're young.
Anybody
adults,
younger than us as a kid, we know how that works.
That they're reporting things like, you know, my parents expect me to be an Olympian. My parents expect me to be a professional athlete.
That's right.
And a bit much higher percentage. My parents expected me from a young age to be a college athlete. And so, you know, as a researcher, obviously that catches my attention. Even more so as a parent, I changed my language with my own kids as a result of a lot of what I've learned. So I don't tell my kids, I expect you to be an athlete in college. What I tell them, and I think both of my kids are capable of being, you know, going down that path should they choose it. But I always tell them, this is your choice. This is your first real major adult decision, is where you go to college and whether or not you choose to commit your time to being an athlete in college.
Or whether you go to college at all. I mean, that's the other piece, is that we've grown into the society where we're going to start their college savings account the day that they're born. Well, what pressure does that put on a kid? So we've got a friend of ours that went to lineman school, and he's making $30,000 a month stringing lines, traveling all around the country. He'll retire at probably 35, 40 years old with more money than most people that have a PhD. Will retire at 75. So, you know, we've gotten this thing in our society where, yeah, you'll do this and you'll do that, and we're planning our kids' lives out for them without giving them any say in it whatsoever. I would imagine that would create pressure, which could lead to burnout, just that alone.
Yeah, absolutely. Any time you're putting chronic, you know, a person is experiencing chronic stress, then it can lead to it. Now, that's not to say that every person, every athlete doesn't experience some level of burnout during the course of a season. You know, there's research that shows that basically burnout kind of progresses over the course of a season, and, you know, towards the end of the season, it kind of peaks, which I think instinctively for anybody probably that's been a coach, you know, can kind of guess that that makes a lot of sense. You're exhausted from the course of a season, maybe have dealt with injuries.
Right.
So, I mean, definitely don't want to convey that experiencing any type of burnout means you are for sure going to quit or withdraw from your sport. You know, there's times where it kind of ebbs and flows for sure, depending on the person and the personality and the season, you know, and what their experience is with the season.
Well, that's normal, right? I mean, even if we're working in an accounting firm and we love our jobs and we always dreamed of being an accountant and we're doing it, you still need a vacation. You still feel that stress build up and you feel burnt out for a short period of time. So I can completely, I think what you're saying makes complete sense to most people that would be listening to this, that it doesn't mean you're necessarily going to be quitting, but chronic burnout syndrome, if we're, I don't know what we would term it, but that feeling where it's arising more frequently and lasting for longer periods of time, can certainly lead to athletes saying, this isn't worth it anymore. It's not, I'm not having fun anymore. I'm not enjoying this.
Yeah, and I don't have a future in this anyway, so what am I doing this for?
Which is wild, right? I mean, why do we do sports? Where do, you know, I used to teach a class in college called Sports and Society, right? So basically sociology of sports. And you know, we talk about in the Industrial Revolution, we began to have a little more leisure time. That leisure time led to activities, youth activities, sports, Little League began, you know, in the 40s, I think. And so it was meant to be fun and recreational. And now we've turned it into a job for, well, heck, I see 11 and 12 year olds promoting themselves. I highly suspect it's their parents promoting them, but promoting themselves, it's become a job at 10, 11, 12 years old to build your brand, right? And if you don't build your brand, you're not playing in college, so you better get to work. You're behind at 10 years old, you're behind at 12. Which is insanity to me, complete insanity.
We're setting them up for expect. I've seen a lot of people, I'm sure you've heard it and seen it. A 6-year-old has a good game, runs back and forth on the field and scores 10 goals, and they're getting told you're D1. And so, what if they're not D1? What if they're a Division II player? What if they choose to go to a Division III school? Are they a failure? Should they feel like that's not a significant accomplishment? I had my daughter say something like that to me one day. So and so said, I'm going D1. And I said, you're going to go to whatever school is a great fit for you based on the goals you want to accomplish. And I will be equally proud of you if that's an AIA school, if that's Division III, if that's Division II. Let's not focus on that. It's all a good accomplishment. And I think sometimes parents want to be able to post, my kid went D1. Well, you're kind of setting that kid up for if they don't go D1, they're a failure, in your eyes and
Right.
or in the academic, I mean in the athletic community. And it just doesn't make any sense to me to put that pressure and stress and level of expectations on kids from such a young age.
Well, and honestly, that drives me crazy because when people say you are D1, on the women's side, I've used the number 9, it's broken it down, but I think there's 9 different levels of Division I. There is everything from North Carolina down to whoever the 0 win for 5 years in a row, worst ranked program in the country that probably can't beat your local high school team that operates under the Division I rules. Division I is simply a set of rules in which a school chooses to organize themselves under because there is no promotion and relegation. You know, you can't be the best Division III country team in the country for 10 years in a row, and now you are competing with North Carolina. It doesn't work that way. So it's always silly when people say you're a D1 athlete. It's like, especially on the women's side, it's like, yeah, you probably are. You probably could go play for the worst Division I school in the country that hasn't won a game in the last 10 years. They are probably correct. And then players go, but I don't want to go to that school. Well, because it's not the right fit for you, right? That's what you're looking at. And you're so spot on, Aaron, with saying just put all the labels aside for 30 seconds and just find the school that's the right fit and then figure out what label it is. It's so crazy that we put this much pressure on our kids. So what do you think parents, let's start with parents, What are some recommendations that you can give to parents? Because I think it's mostly parents that listen to our website. Sometimes they listen to it in the car with their kids, but I think it's mostly parents that listen to our podcast. Sorry. What are some recommendations that you have for parents to reduce the risk of burnout in their kids and to help their kids enjoy the game more?
I think so. A couple of things. One is it is important for them to have an identity outside of just being an athlete. So I think our inclination as we're trying to keep up with the sports Joneses, if you will, is
Yep.
to schedule them and make sure they're training and, individual training, team training, athletic conditioning. They're doing all of the things, but we don't leave time for fun, which is ultimately, even at the highest levels, why people want to play sports. And
Right.
so resisting that urge to feel like, oh, so and so's training today, I need to make sure that my kid's training. That's important because they have to have an identity outside of being an athlete. And so, I think of it this way. If my child had a career-ending injury, a car accident that you don't know, tomorrow, would they feel like they're still a person after
Right.
that? And when your entire identity is wrapped up in just your athletic capabilities, that's putting them at some risk for these types of issues. So when I talk to my kids, based on my years as a researcher, it's you are a person who is talented as an athlete. I don't say you're an athlete because they're many things. So it's
Right.
acknowledging the other parts of their personality. That's a big thing, I think, that can help with making sure that even if they have an issue where they're not playing as much as they would like to, they're not getting as much playing time, they're not putting the entire weight of their personality and self-confidence in the number of minutes that they get. So that's a big thing. I think giving them, the opportunity to try different sports and play different sports is definitely important. I think I've seen that you've, commented sometimes about things like early specialization. It definitely, puts girls at risk. And then I think just the amount of pressure, making sure that the amount of pressure we put on them is appropriate. There's a lot of things parents can do. I posted kind of the six things I think that I do differently based on what I've learned as a parent and researcher. And certainly I am not always the perfect sports parent, but I definitely changed how I parent my kids based on my years as a researcher.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah, no, my wife and I, our son at 10 years old announced he was going to go play in England. And of course, I internally rolled my eyes. I didn't externally do it. I'm not a monster, but it's like I knew how hard it was. My wife and I began to become concerned at about 14, what happens if he doesn't make it? And we developed a phrase for the next 4 years, soccer is something you do, it's not who you are.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I put
Yeah.
no pressure on my kids to be a college athlete.
Right.
My discussion with them is you have to be active in something through high school. After that, if you choose not to be an athlete and you go to college, you're getting a job. But
Right.
I always tell my kids, I had my time. I was the star high school athlete, a banner in my high school for scoring 105 goals and, two-time MVP of the Philadelphia Catholic League. And I went to college.
Right.
I did my part. Now it's your turn, it's your decision. And I always say, if you choose to be a college athlete, here's the work ethic you need to have you can't have UNC goals, but a rec league work ethic.
Right.
But you can go to college if you want. We are prepared to support you in that. And but I don't care. You're not hurting my feelings if you tell me one day,
Right.
because
I love that. Yeah.
I always come back to my why. Why do I want my kids to play sports?
Right.
And it's hard. I think you put parents on a sideline, and a lot of times, we're people who grew up playing sports. We're competitive. We're probably still competitive to some extent. And so, but I always, in my moments where I'm like, oh, I really don't like what's going on, I come back to, why do I want my kids to play? Well, I want my kids to play sports. One, I want them to be active physically because that's good for their mental health. I want them to have fun. I want them to learn how to navigate conflict and conversations with coaches and deal with wins and losses and
Right.
all these things that I look for in the people that work for me every day.
Right.
So when I'm having a moment where I'm frustrated over something as a parent, I always come back to, why do I even want my kids to play sports? And to me, that is worth every penny that I invest in it. I'm investing in them becoming, functioning members of society and hopefully leaders in an organization or entrepreneurs, that whatever path they go down.
I think that's really good advice, and I would encourage every parental units, people that are taking care of kids, to ask themselves that question frequently to make sure that they're still on track with the right reasons. And if the reasons are externally motivated, well, to get a scholarship, I want them to play so that they can play in college, I want them to play so they can be a professional. By the way, those things are really not in your control at all. The coaches are in control of those decisions. So that's extremely externally motivated factors that I could see could lead to burnout if the kids realize that I've done everything right, but I'm still haven't made it. What's wrong with me? Nothing's wrong with you. It's not your decision at the end of the day. So the other side of the equation, I think that's great advice for parents, by the way, but the other side of the equation is coaches. And I know a lot of coaches listen to this podcast too. Youth coaches and college coaches. So, what advice do you have for college coaches to minimize the risk of athlete burnout?
Recognizing, and I'm sure most college coaches do, the set of expectations and pressures and that are on, these student athletes. College NCAA data shows that, I mean, it being a college athlete specifically is the equivalent of working two full-time jobs. And players want coaches who see them as a full person, not just a number on, on the roster. That helps a lot. One of the things, Don, that was super surprising to me actually in my research was the number of players who I talked to that had sustained injuries. So if I were giving the coaches another suggestion, it would be to make sure you're looking out for and checking in on injured players. Some of the women who, almost half of the people that I interviewed had sustained some injuries. And what they talked about was they were still required to go to all of the team functions, but then they had to squeeze in their physical therapy or their recovery
Right.
efforts. And I think that's probably, if I'm a coach, well-intentioned. You still want the person to be part, feel like they're part of the team. But really, for a period of time, they need to be focusing on their recovery, and making sure they have the resources available to focus on their recovery. Because especially if you have a scholarship athlete, what they're worrying about is, I have to get back to prove my worth. And I heard that from a number of the women is I sustained, you know, this injury. I had to squeeze in PT. I didn't get the adequate opportunity to ramp up my training and minutes because I was so worried about losing my scholarship and getting back to where I was. And this, you know, what was interesting about it is this wasn't their feelings around this lasted for years after they were a college athlete. So you think about the long-term implications. Some of the women talked about how they, for years after they stopped playing, they couldn't think about soccer, had a healthy relationship with the gym, unhealthy relationship with food, you know, all of these long-term impacts of this experience. So my second tip to coaches would be to really look out for those who were injured and think about whether or not as an organization, as an administration, the athletes who were injured are feeling, you know, supported in their recovery. You know, and then the third thing is the team environment. It really matters. I had a really smart, experienced coach tell me one time that women have to like each other to perform, and men have to perform to like each other.
Right. Right.
And it's really true. One of the most important things I heard about was women feeling included. And that includes women's views around coaches picking favorites. I mean, I was surprised to hear the number of times I heard about coaches picking favorites and what the impact was. One woman told me, she said, I burned myself out trying to become a favorite.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
She said all of the extra training I did, you know, I just tried really hard. You know, the people pleaser in her, I'm sure, tried really hard. I saw the special treatment that the favorites were getting. And I burned myself out trying to be one.
Wow. That's powerful. Yeah. Like you said, the long-term effects are something that we have to really consider. So how would you recommend from the coach's perspective and from the parental perspective that we bridge the gap so that coach and parent are working the same direction and not sending conflicting messages to kids?
A lot we could do from a young age to educate parents. I feel like, you know, a lot of the pressure and stress is well-intentioned. And I think some of it, you know, if you, I truly believe when you know better, you do better. So I think there's an opportunity to educate parents and then coaches too. I really think it stems from communication and open dialogue between coaches to players, parents to players, coaches to parents. You know, that gets more complicated when you obviously get into a college setting where there's a lot less communication between you hope between the parents and the coaches at that point.
Right.
I mean, that,
you know, what really... that feeling is even happening at the youth level, though. I mean, I see coaches post online, I don't want to talk to the parents. The parents shouldn't be approaching me. And we're talking about minors. We're talking about, you know, younger kids. So I think that idea that the perception that some coaches have that their level is above the parents and they shouldn't be dealing with the parents, I think that's an ill-conceived notion.
Well, and in most cases, the parents are the one paying your salary.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, so you got to recognize who the actual customer is in that case.
Absolutely, Erin. Yeah. What are some resources, Erin, that parents and coaches alike could could look for and be able to utilize to find out more about how they can support their athletes and help prevent burnout.
You know, there's not a ton of resources out there. What's interesting is, I mean, I think there's some things that you could just find online. I mean, there's other people like me who have done similar research. But there's not a one single or just a couple specific sources that I could point somebody to and say, you know, this is the place for the resources. I think for coaches specifically, I think it would be great to for coaches to take a look at the NCAA website. They certainly have a research center, and a lot of the information that I share is from there. The NCAA every couple of years does well-being reports, and I think every coach in college specifically should be looking at that. I think even youth coaches could benefit from flipping through those reports. They're charts and graphs and easily, you know, digestible, but it gives you a sense for what's going on. You don't see it necessarily. It's college student data, but to think that those similar things are not going on at the youth level, that's not, you know, that's not the case. It's definitely happening at the youth level. So that provides just a wealth of information for parents and coaches to take a look at and to reflect on. Are my behaviors, you know, consistent with my why for why my kids play sports?
Right. No, that makes sense. I'll recommend Dan Abrahams. He's got a book for coaches called Soccer Brain. He's got two for players called Soccer Tough and Soccer Tough Two. And it really does try, Dan does a good job of trying to bring it back to the internal motivation as opposed to the external. Because I just know, as observing a lot of athletes, if you truly love your sport and if you're in love with the sport, and you can hold that love of the sport with you, that burnout is much less likely if you're doing it because you love to do it, not for a reason. And the other two resources that I would mention to our audience is Positive Coaching Alliance, which is a group that was originally formed out of Stanford. And the other one is the Reform Sports Project. Nick Bonacore has done a great job with the Reform Sports Project, and his podcasts are great. And it really is all tying together into the topic that we're talking about. And that is remembering that sports are supposed to be fun, and they're supposed to be an outlet for our kids, and they're supposed to be good life lessons that are brought forward out of it. And it shouldn't necessarily be a means to an end of professional and college ball.
Yeah, he's really great. I agree with you. The Reform Sports Project. I look at his content and it's really great. I see a lot of the sports parents that I interact with repost his information. So I think
Great.
he really does touch on this. I think the other thing that coaches, parents should be thinking about is how is my kid contributing to the environment? So, you know, the second piece of my research was around what types of leadership behaviors do can support kids, not, you know, adults, kids, college students not burning out, and which ones make it worse. And I think, you know, if parents are talking to their kids about what does it mean to be a good teammate, what does that look like, you know, and coaches. I was surprised by the number of college athletes who told me our leaders, the seniors, the captains, they didn't have some set of expectations. They didn't have training. And when you look at the NCAA data about why women specifically transfer, a lot of it has to do with conflict. Caused by teammates or coaches, and so that those leaders influence the experience for everybody. And is the environment inclusive, or are there a bunch of cliques? It was very telling to me that most of the women I talked to who had, you know, experienced athlete burnout talked about some type of cliques in their environment and the impact that that had feeling left out. So, you know, one thing parents can do is if you don't want your kids to have a bad athletic experience, make sure you're not encouraging, you know, that type of exclusion behaviors. And coaches the same.
I love it. I love it. Well, Aaron, I really appreciate you coming on there. Is there anything that you want to plug? Where can people find you?
Yeah, absolutely. People can find me on Twitter. That's really the primary place that I am focused on sharing my information right now. And you can find me at Erin K, E-R-I-N-K underscore Henderson. And that's really the primary place that I'm sharing information at this point.
Yeah, and everybody, look, she's sharing almost daily. I loved that you dug up the NCAA data. I took that and I reposted that right away. And I think parents need to look at that. And as you said, if you think parents that it doesn't relate to your youth, you're wrong. It absolutely carries backwards into the youth, not just forward into the college. Aaron, thank you for spending an hour with us and sharing your wealth of knowledge. And please, everybody, follow Aaron. And she's just got fantastic information that she posts on a regular basis on the well-being of our athletes. So thank you, Aaron.
Thank you very much for having me.